Radio. Hello, this is John Bowker. On June 22, 2002, the Tampa, Florida Tribune printed an item entitled "Competitors Air Concerns with Clear Channel Communications," and its subheadline was "Yet Some Rivals Copy the Strategy to Compete." This is an item reprinted by permission from the New York Times. It reads as follows. Wall Street admires the nation's largest radio broadcasting conglomerate, Clear Channel Communications, as a fast-growing, profitable multimedia empire. It includes the largest chain of radio stations, five times as many as its nearest rival, and the biggest collection of billboards, as well as growing collections of television stations and concert halls. Among its competitors and some cultural critics, however, Clear Channel is referred to as the evil empire, or worse. They complain that the company based in San Antonio, Texas, has made its money by filling its broadcasts with prefabricated and non-local programming. But in some ways, many rivals of Clear Channel, including Cumulus Media, the Infinity Radio Unit of Viacom, and Citadel Communications, are increasingly copying it. They are courting advertisers and listeners with moves that come directly from Clear Channel's playbook. They're also scrambling to acquire more stations. The reason is simple. Clear Channel in the past 2 years has acquired enough stations, 1,200, about one-tenth of all radio stations, to dominate the industry. It ranks number one in five of the top 10 markets and number two in four others, sometimes commanding more than a third of all listeners. In some top 25 markets, about half of all listeners tune in to Clear Channel stations. Inside Radio, an independent industry newsletter, estimates Clear Channel has a larger national audience than the four next largest broadcasters combined. Being up against those guys is forcing us to become more resourceful, said Lewis Dickey, chairman and chief executive of Cumulus, the number two radio broadcaster as measured by the number of stations. It owns 248. They are very aggressive, so now we're more aggressive. They've set the standard that we're responding to. Clear Channel's aggressive approach includes cost-cutting. It has replaced many local radio hosts, for example, with recorded music programs spiked with local color for individual stations, or with syndicated talk show hosts such as Rush Limbaugh and Laura Schlesinger. But with 770,000 billboards, 135 concert halls, and 19 television stations, with 18 more being acquired, Clear Channel has also the resources to undercut competitors on price while wooing advertisers with cross-promotions. Few rivals, for example, can promote a music group on their stations, book the act in their clubs and amphitheaters, and then advertise the tour on their billboards. There's a very strong sentiment that they have done a disservice to broadcasting by using their clout in a way that makes it difficult for smaller companies to compete, said Reed Bunsell, chief editor of Radio Inc., another trade publication. A lot of people in the business really hate Clear Channel, he said. None of this has stopped other broadcasters from adopting many strategies pioneered by Clear Channel, including million-dollar contests for listeners. Some competitors have started working together to ask advertisers to place ads with them as a group to counter Clear Channel's new push to sign exclusive deals to pitch products across its empire. Competitors are also bulking up. Dickey said Cumulus, which is based in Atlanta, would try to double or triple in size during the next 3 to 5 years through acquisitions. The one thing we've learned from Clear Channel is the advantage of size and scale, he said. Now, beyond the big companies, thousands of one- and two-station broadcasters are hunkering down in their markets, lacking the capital to grow, but mindful that radio is a local medium, these smaller companies are working to counter Clear Channel's national reach by appealing more to local advertisers, sending disc jockeys to car dealership promotions and high school football games, for example. With its size and muscle, Clear Channel has prompted complaints from rivals that it resembles a monopoly, and the Federal Communications Commission has said it's investigating the company and other broadcasters to see whether consolidation has resulted in less diversity in programming. Senator Russell Feingold, a Democrat of Wisconsin, is preparing a bill that would impose restrictions on the radio and concert industries, in part because of Clear Channel's tactics. And an Illinois woman has filed a class action lawsuit in federal district court in New York, accusing Clear Channel of using its market power to inflate the price of concert tickets. For 2001, Clear Channel's radio business had revenue of approximately $3.4 billion. That's 43% of the company's total. The article in the Tampa Tribune concludes with a listing of the Clear Channel Communications radio stations in the Tampa area. They include WDAE, 620 AM, WFLA, 970 AM, WHNZ, 1250 AM, and the remaining five stations all on the FM dial, WXTB, 97.9, WFLZ, 93.3, WSSR, 95.7, WMTX at 100.7, and WTBT, 103.5.
Treating Viewers as Criminals by Henry Jenkins of MIT Technology Review. Networks say watching TV without the ads is theft. Will blipverts be next? Remember blipverts? The 1980s science fiction series, Max Headroom, depicted a society 20 minutes into the future, ruled by powerful television networks, locked in ruthless competition for viewer eyeballs. Concerned by the growing trend toward channel surfing, the blipvert was developed as a rapid-fire subliminal advertisement, which pumps its commercial message directly into consumers' brains before they had a chance to change the channel. Unfortunately, the blipvert had an unanticipated side effect of causing spontaneous combustion in a certain number of overweight and chronically inactive couch potatoes. This outcome was viewed as an acceptable risk by the networks, even though it potentially decreased the number of viewers for their programs. I could not help but think about blipverts the other day when I stumbled across a recent comment of Turner Broadcasting Systems CEO Jamie Kellner, who asserted that television viewers who skipped commercials using their digital video recorders were guilty of stealing broadcast content. Kellner told a industry trade press reporter that your contract with the network when you get the show is that you're going to watch the spots. He conceded that there may be a historic loophole allowing us to take a short break to go to the bathroom, but otherwise, we are expected to be at our posts, doing our duties, watching every commercial, and presumably, though he never said it, buying every product. Kellner's intemperate rhetoric is, alas, characteristic of the ways that the media industry increasingly thinks about, talks about, and addresses its consumers in the post-Napster era. Napster may, and I stress, may have legitimately labeled piracy, but now all forms of consumerism are being criminalized with ever-increasing degrees of credibility. Once going to the bathroom or grabbing a snack on a commercial break gets treated as a form of theft, the media conglomerates are going to be hard-pressed to get consumer compliance with their expectations, making it impossible to draw legitimate lines about what is and what is not appropriate use of media content. Name-calling is the last resort of a once-powerful institution that are finding themselves losing control in the face of rapid media change. Never mind that the same media giants are often the manufacturers of the news media technologies we are using to skip their commercials, or that some of the advertisements they want us to watch are marketing us features which allow us to skip advertisements. Never mind that we now have many more media options, and we need the networks far less than the networks need us. I don't know about you, but I want to renegotiate my contract. There has been a significant increase in the number of commercials per hour since I first watched television network programming. Consequently, my workload has doubled or tripled, while the compensation, the programming, has gone down in quantity, if not quality. One wonders whether it isn't time for television viewers to form a union, demand that people like Kellner sit down at the negotiating table and cut a better deal with us, if they continue to expect viewer loyalty. And given research linking extensive television viewing with obesity, Perhaps we might have some way of holding the networks accountable for their workplace safety violations as well, before some of us start to spontaneously explode. But seriously, the networks do not and never have had contracts with consumers, compensating us for the labor we perform in watching commercials. They do, however, have contracts with advertisers, promising them a certain number of eyeballs in return for their financial support for broadcast content. And in the new media age, they are increasingly failing to make good on those agreements.
Ken Anischuk here reporting. A talking encyclopedia, jazz DJ Dick Buckley, connects the present with the good old good ones he knows so well. He says, radio is the most intimate broadcast medium, creating a mood, setting a tone, putting pictures in the mind. There is an adage within the industry, quote, good radio is like a voice at the kitchen table. Dick Buckley has brought that kind of voice to Chicago radio for 45 years. Each weekly broadcast on 91.5 WBEZ is another chapter in the Buckley Book of Jazz, a narrative he weaves with his programming selections and wry commentary delivered in a rumbling baritone between the numbers. Long on music and short on hyperbole, the broadcasts favor musicians who pioneered the idiom from New Orleans in the early 1900s through the close of the swing era around 1950. Buckley approaches jazz as a web of connections, record labels, nightclubs, producers, liner note writers, and store owners, as well as the artists, and his knowledge is inexhaustible. Many jazz aficionados came of age listening to his dry wit and anecdotes about the music as a kind of metaphor about life. Studs Terkel, the author and longtime radio personality who worked with Buckley in the 1950s, says, Dick is in the tradition of the old-time jazz critics I loved so much. There is always that thread running through Dick's commentary, the connection of past and present, respect for long gone. And there's the voice, says Larry Smith, his friend and late-night jazz programmer at WBEZ, where Buckley has worked since 1977. He's got that big, wide, melodious voice, well-controlled, a wonderful sound. Although his voice doesn't show it, Buckley is 76 now. His career reel matches the odyssey of jazz radio. But a year and a half ago, the reel almost stopped. He felt a surge of pain in his right side and ended up in the hospital for heart surgery. He was gone from the air for 6 months, and rumors spread he was gone for good. But the old lion came back, and he's been on the air steadily for more than a year. Even before surgery, Buckley had been recording the program at his home in Oak Park in a makeshift studio, bulging with tapes, CDs, vinyl, and audio gear. He mails digital audio tapes of the broadcast at WBEZ, which runs two shows ahead of the one he tapes. I'm Dick Buckley here with your jazz records, a recent broadcast began. Happens every Sunday from noon to 3. 3 hours of good jazz sounds, traditional and mainstream. Here's Woody Herman and the famous Herman's Herd. This one here is from an old gold broadcast, August 2nd, 1944. Then comes a knowing pause. How many of listeners remember that old gold was once a popular brand of cigarettes? Continues Buckley, actually, this is from a rehearsal for the broadcast. And, another pause, a trace of scorn. They don't tell us who did the arrangement, but it was probably Ralph Burns, although it might have well been Ray Wetzel. After several minutes of vintage swing, Buckley is back, previewing the next number, featuring trumpeter Pee Wee Russell. Chicago and All That Jazz was the name of the album on the Verve album label, he says, running down the roster of other players on the session, including trombonist Jack Teagarden, who does the vocals on a cut called Logan Square. Continues Buckley, the album came from a TV show that didn't last. Too bad the networks didn't do more of that. Perhaps jazz didn't bring in the ratings they hoped for. Everything is based on ratings. How many people are listening? He begins, I was born in 1924, a child of radio. We're sitting in a diner in Oak Park on a gray Saturday. Buckley is an imposing figure, a barrel-chested man whose silver hair and matching beard suggests an oldest Irving Hemingway. Well, he's eating much of his hamburger and starts talking. My dad worked for GE, so he had a radio, and I grew up listening to it. Home was Decatur, Indiana, a town with a huge soybean plant. On a trip to nearby Fort Wayne when he was 16, Buckley bought a copy of Downbeat, the influential jazz magazine. On a return trip, he bought records by Bob Crosby and the Bobcats. On the third visit, he asked the salesman, "What's new?" The man showed him a Duke Ellington record, and that just turned my taste buds around completely. Like most early jazz historians and critics and DJs, Buckley began as a record collector. The sense of discovery with each new disc triggered a chain reaction. Goodman to Ellington to Artie Shaw, then Harry James and Gene Krupa, on to Tommy Dorsey, and then to a segue to the drummer Big Sid Catlett, and from Sid to the Majesty Louis Armstrong. Each issue of Downbeat fed his hunger for records and his curiosity about the outer reaches of jazz. He says of his high school discovery period, 35 cents was a lot in those days. Victor and Columbia records were 75 cents. Commodore and Blue Note were a dollar. I had a paper out in high school, and I had to sell a lot of papers. I played trombone in a little high school orchestra. Tommy Dorsey playing astounded me. He had tremendous breath control. Today I listen to Dorsey records, and I breathe along. Buckley left home for Indiana University and landed a slot with a marching band. Before World War II interrupted his education, he took an English class that provided formative in his radio career. The professor was Marshall Stearns, a literary scholar who had fallen in love with jazz and was writing about it for various publications. In 1956, Stearns would publish an important early history, The Story of Jazz. Said Buckley, warming to memories, "My mind was like a sponge." Stearns couldn't understand how this Hoosier kid loved jazz. He used to invite me to his house. He had a great collection. In July of 1943, Buckley joined the Army Armed Forces and got another nudge toward destiny when he ended up at an air base in Denver that had a small radio station. When he read copy at an audition test, the sergeant said, "You got a hell of a good voice," he calls. He worked at the station from 6 in the morning till 10 at night, taking network feeds, programming big band music. "We lived at the station," he says. After the war, Buckley headed home and put in a year at Indiana University without a sense of direction. Then he saw an ad for the Radio Institute of Chicago. He took classes for 6 months and refined his radio voice. "I had to overcome the Hoosier accent. I didn't know they had one." The experience helped land him at his first job in 1948, when I was born, at WANE-AM in Fort Wayne. It paid $40 a week, he recalls, one of those jobs where you do everything but sweep the floor. Stretches at WFMM and WISH in Indianapolis followed, then 2 years of promotional work for Norman Granz's, Clef, and Norgran jazz labels. In 1956, Buckley moved to Chicago as an announcer at WAAF AM 950. In those days, commercial stations had a sink-or-swim system. Broadcast personalities would pay for their own program time by selling advertisers' products on the air and splitting the revenue with the station. He says, "It was the worst kind of radio. You produce or you're out." He was the announcer for Studs Place, a Studs Terkel program on WAAF, and worked on various other programs selling TV sets, storm windows, and sewing machines. Buckley was pleased that his voice was becoming a marketable commodity, but he was irked at the station manager's hostility to jazz. One guy played George Shearing, and the manager said, "Why are you playing that ping-pong music?" as he rolled his eyes. "George Shearing? Les Brown was almost too far out." The man who turned WAAF's jazz policy around was a legendary DJ known as Holmes Daddy O'Daly. He had national sponsors like Pet Milk, he says. He would not take cheap accounts. When Daddy O came in with national accounts, the station manager got interested. Now, jazz was the thing. In off hours, Buckley hosted a jazz show on a just-developing FM station, WNIB Chicago. The owner, Bill Florian, liked classical music, but believed jazz deserved a format. It was strictly hand-to-mouth operation, he recalls. "I worked for him for 10 years. I did 2 shifts a day, one at WAAF from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. as a staff announcer, then at WNIB as a jazz DJ from 7 to 9 p.m. The pivotal event in Buckley's life occurred shortly after he arrived in Chicago. An insurance company down the hall from the station had a secretary named Marge Reuter. She was a beauty, but he couldn't find anyone to introduce him. So I found out what time she came to work, and I bumped into her. Once we met, I didn't go out with anybody else. The first date was a Stan Kenton concert. They got married in 1956, the day before his 32nd birthday, and had 3 kids in 4 years, Jan, Jim, and Jeff. I consider myself one of the luckiest men in the world, he says. Another good thing that happened to me, everything good that's happened to me has come from her. In 1967, Buckley took a better-paying job at AMA 20 WAIT. He grimaces as he recalls the playlist. Not bad, though. Percy Faith, 101 Strings, Robert Goulet. The family was growing and I needed the money. The general manager wouldn't allow me to work for any other stations, so for 10 years there was no jazz at work. I'd go home at night and listen to Ellington and Bass and Basie, but it was Zoot Sims I played the most. And finishing here, in the 1970s, Schlitz took on a freelance project as the voice of Schlitz Beer, Schlitz, Milwaukee, and the world. For a time, he was the voice of all the Schlitz radio and TV commercials in the United States. It was so lucrative, it was scary, he said. In 1977, WAIT changed to an all-talk format, and Buckley was out. I guess they thought I couldn't talk, he complains. He landed at WBEZ, taking a big salary cut, but gaining the freedom to program jazz 3 hours a night. At one point, he and his producer, Christine Heim, had clashes over the programming. I was told you can't play a new release unless it's added to the format, he said. If it isn't in the format, you're going to play it only once a month. He'd been playing what he wanted for years, spinning in his own musical orbit beyond the station's format. As the dispute deepened, Buckley threatened to quit, but management smoothed things over and he has settled back into his old groove, content that the viewers like the music he plays as he plays it. Heim did not return calls for an interview for this article. Buckley's passion for jazz does not extend much past the late bebop players. He has little use for Ornette Coleman or John Coltrane. After a disquisition into Wynton Marsalis' technical prowess but creative limitations, Buckley says his brother Branford is a better jazz player. As for Ken Burns' jazz epic on PBS, it was good for the music. I just wish there had been more music on the program. I'm lucky to have lived and seen the great ones, he reflects, as he encountered decades ago in Decatur, Indiana, Dizzy and Bird, Charlie Parker, Count Basie and Duke Ellington. Teddy Wilson's influenced all jazz players in the swing era. You can hear Teddy's early records and know he came straight from Earl Hines. Kids today don't hear that kind of progression. He smiles. There's nothing I like to do better than talk.
Good afternoon, DX Audio Service and National Radio Club fans. It is almost 2:30 Eastern Daylight Time, Wednesday, September 1st. We are across the river from Detroit in Canada, across from the United States. We made it into CBC Radio Windsor. We are here at the station. It's a beautiful, marvelous station. Of course, CBEF, I-40, CBE, 1550, the FM station, and television. Anyway, I had a very nice tour with Rochelle Porter, Program Marketing Coordinator for all CBC stations here in Windsor. Years ago, verified CBE and had the cards I did show to Rochelle and the receptionist here. They have a nice table of literature which I'm bringing to the convention for all the stations. The building here is large. It's very visible. It's right here on Riverside Drive, and we have a nice view actually of Detroit on the other side of the river. But anyway, let's talk about CBC, and thank you, Rochelle, for letting us come here today.
Okay. Well, first I have to say that we don't usually give individual tours. This was a special circumstance, because I really don't want the people thinking they can
just walk in.
Just walk in.
Right. Okay. So don't walk in and expect anything, but anyway, thank you.
But you can check us out on our website at cbc.ca,
okay?
CBC Radio has existed since 1936 in Canada, but it was 1950 that CBC Radio in Windsor at 1550 in the AM dial first went on air. So we will be celebrating next summer our 50th birthday. And if you do find the Windsor site as the year progresses towards our anniversary, which is July 1st, we might have some information that if anybody is interested in coming and attending, there will be special events happening.
Right. Our Canadian members will really be interested. In fact, probably some of the members in U.S. also, too. But anyway, Please just give a brief explanation of all the stations that we just saw here today.
Okay, I don't know much about CBEF 540 because that's French,
right.
And I only look after the English side of it. We have a number of programs that are produced live from this station. Weekdays, our early morning show with host Paul Vesey, 6 to 9 a.m. in the morning, and our drive-home show from 4 to 6 is with Barbara Peacock. We also have a daily insert with a Southwestern correspondent in a program called Ontario Today, which is heard throughout the province, and that's noon to 2. We also have at the top of each hour throughout the week national, international, and local newscasts that are done from this site here.
You said the building. Okay, you've been here since 1950 then, so this is the original location.
Well, the original location for radio was downtown Windsor, which was about 3/4 of a mile away, but in 1994, we moved in. TV has been in this building since 1974, CBC TV.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1994, we amalgamated, so that it's only been since 1994 that radio has actually been in this building working
right.
alongside with CBC TV.
Right. And of course, you explained to me about the policies of CBC programming towards the people.
But also, they're one important factor, particularly for Americans, is our programming is driven by Canada, by being Canadian. So our stories are about Canadians, and we are mandated by our federal regulatory body, the CRTC, that our stories have to be about Canadians, or at least a Canadian experience or Canadian point of view. So if ever you hear something of a report from Detroit or a report from anywhere else, say in the States, by a CBC correspondent, it's usually because it's taking a Canadian point of view, telling Canadians who listen to CBC or watch CBC TV, you know, what's happening there.
Right.
We're mandated to do that.
Okay.
The CBC Radio has no commercials. We are totally publicly funded, and there is an arm's length agreement between the government and the CBC not to have any interference or sway as far as our news stories.
Okay. And, of course, we know about the AM stations in Canada. The government has shut down CBM and CBL for financial reasons, moving to FM, and what you told me about digital radio also, but they haven't done so with 1550.
CBE is on the AM band, and we will remain so for a number of reasons. One is that in this market, there is no room on the FM band. It is the It's saturated. It's the most saturated market in North America, I believe that's true. So first of all, there is no placement for us to go. First and second of all, the expense of it. Recently, within the past year, CBL and CBM, that's Toronto CBC and Montreal CBC, did get moved from AM band to an FM band. Not only because there was a frequency available, but because it was considered to be cost-effective, that there are in Toronto a potential of 6 million listeners within their listening area. Here we're talking about 200,000 to 300,000 in the extended market. So financially it wouldn't be feasible if there were a spot on the dial, on the FM band. But even more importantly, in another few years, radio will become digitalized. So digital radio will be the thing. And that's why recently CBC Radio has gone, instead of calling their services CBC Radio or CBC Stereo, because we have two English networks, we call it CBC Radio 1 and CBC Radio 2 to accommodate the change that is about to come. So AM and FM band in that world will be non-existent,
right.
So it really won't matter.
Right. And I know, well, just a little bit, that England does that also, BBC One, Radio One, and Two, and Three.
No, they've done it right from the beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And, of course, it seems like sometimes we're always a step behind things. I know that sometimes Canada will do something, and then the U.S. Will say, you know, we should maybe go along and do this, too.
You didn't do that with the metric when we went to metric.
I know. We had all the numbers up and everything, but nobody paid attention to it anyway. What was I going to say? That
about digital.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Now, again, I'm not a technical expert, but I do understand that there are different systems when it comes to what kind of digital
radio
people
have. And you were talking about how the automakers will program the radios for the
Canadians. This is an assumption on my part, of course, but what I do understand, known to be true, is that the Canadian government has chosen to, when we do go to digital, to use a system that is, I believe, the European system, which is totally different than the American digital system, as it will be in the future, which, of course, means that if you live in Canada and you buy a radio in Canada, you'll be able to receive radio, Canadian radio, but you will not be able to pick up American radio, which poses a problem, particularly living on the border, of when you buy a car in Windsor. Maybe you will have a choice, but what do you think you'll choose? Will you choose an American digital radio where you have over 50 stations, or will you choose a Canadian digital radio which has maybe half a dozen?
Right.
And so chances are, if there is that choice, that Canadians, at least in this area, will probably choose the American, even for their homes.
Right.
I mean, so it sort of makes one ponder about what will be the effect of that on listeners, audience in this area.
Right. Yeah, it's just you don't know, and until you see, you know, it's like what the public wants, or at least get a feel for what they want.
They may come up with a solution way before that.
Right. Maybe they'll accommodate, you'll be able to accommodate both countries. So, but yeah, we do know also that's going to happen when we don't know, and that's part of the reason why I'm here, is it's a documentation of what radio is now,
mm-hmm.
because then when it does change, you know, it will change completely different. And for our club, basically, we all like to preserve history, and that's my end of things anymore. I listen when I do, but not lately. And all the cards and letters I have, they're dated 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. So, but now this is reality, and this is what I enjoy.
The coming reality will be very, very different.
But just being here today and seeing the station and your tour, that was most interesting. And like you said, we don't give tours, but at least I could see, you know, from myself, and at least tell people, you know, what it was like, and I really enjoyed it today, and I thank you very much. And anybody out there, please listen for any updates, CBC Radio here in Windsor, or any the stations.
For our anniversary next.
And for the anniversary next year. But thank you very much, Rochelle, for having me today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. And we'll be back later on. Thank you, fans of National Radio Club and Radio.
CBS Through the Years at a Glance. From the 75th Anniversary Special Edition of Electronic Media. September 18th, 1927. The Columbia Phonograph Broadcasting System begins broadcasting to 16 stations. The radio program consists of members of the New York City Metropolitan Opera performing The King's Henchmen. September 26, 1928, William S. Paley is elected president of the Columbia Broadcasting System, the word phonograph having been dropped. Within a year, Mr. Paley devised a revolutionary plan that would make radio stations want to sign up with the fledgling CBS network, as opposed to the more powerful NBC.
give them free programming in exchange for running national advertising. Fall 1930. The first woman on the air, Natalie Towers, enters into an exclusive contract with a TV station. The station is W2XAB, CBS's experimental station in New York City. July 21, 1931. CBS becomes the first network to begin regular TV programming 28 hours a week on W2XAB in New York. 1932. Newsman Robert Trout is hired. He will later coin the term fireside chat to describe the radio broadcasts of President Franklin Roosevelt. November 8, 1932. CBS-TV reports on the presidential election. March 10, 1933. Experimental TV station W6XAO, later KCBS-TV, goes on the air in Los Angeles. At 5:54 p.m. that day, a major 6.4 magnitude earthquake hits, centered in nearby Long Beach, California. Film of the damage is broadcast the next day. 1935, Edward R. Murrow joins the CBS network. October 30, 1938, Orson Welles' Mercury Theater on the Air broadcasts an adaptation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. Many listeners thought they were hearing reports of an actual Martian invasion. August 29, 1940, CBS Research Director Peter Goldmark announces the invention of color TV. He demonstrates it on September 3rd over W2XAB in New York City. 1948, Mr. Goldmark invents the 33 and a third RPM long playing record. April 1948, it was the first network TV newscast seen on CBS. June 20, 1948, debut of the Toast of the Town with the comedy team of Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin as guests. On September 18, 1955, the series is renamed The Ed Sullivan Show. January 2, 1949, Jack Benny, the number one star in radio, jumps from NBC to CBS. William S. Paley, armed with a clever tax plan and understanding the importance of talent, begins a series of raids on NBC's top talent. October 6, 1949, The Ed Wynn Show becomes the first regularly scheduled network TV show broadcast live from Hollywood instead of New York. June 25, 1951, the beginning of regular network TV color broadcasting. 6 months earlier, the FCC had picked CBS's color system, which was not compatible with the regular black and white as the nation's standard. That same day, CBS took out its first ad in the New York Times for a color TV it was going to manufacture. CBS stopped color broadcasting just 4 months later. TV manufacturers, under pressure from NBC parent RCA, never adopted the CBS system in great numbers. In 1953, the FCC reversed itself and picked a then much improved RCA color-compatible system as the U.S. standard. It became known as NTSC. October 15, 1951, I Love Lucy premieres on CBS. November 18, 1951, See It Now debuts. The show, co-produced by Edward R. Murrow and Fred Friendly, set new standards for public affairs programming. A series of shows in 1954 about Senator Joseph McCarthy, then chairman of a subcommittee trying to root out American communists, helped to end Senator McCarthy's anti-communist hysteria. June 30, 1952. After 15 years on radio, The Guiding Light premieres on TV. September 20, 1952. The Jackie Gleason Show with The Honeymooners debuts. 1956, William S. Paley becomes the primary backer of the upcoming Broadway musical My Fair Lady. The show makes musical comedy history, and the cast album becomes the biggest seller in Columbia Records history, not overtaken until 1970 by the release of Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water. January 28, 1956, Elvis Presley's network TV debut on Stage Show. November 11, 1956, broadcast of the first show on videotape, Douglas Edwards and the News. September 21, 1957, the premiere of Perry Mason. October 2, 1959, The Twilight Zone debuts. March 16, 1962, Walter Cronkite begins anchoring the evening news. 1964, CBS acquires the New York Yankees. The team drops from first to last place in 2 years. February 9, 1964, the Beatles appear on the Ed Sullivan Show. September 24, 1968, 60 Minutes premieres on CBS. January 12, 1971, All in the Family debuts. The show, addressing prejudice and social issues with a candor heretofore unheard on TV, becomes the number one rated show on TV within 6 months. September 4, 1972, The Price is Right, which had been on TV continuously except for 7 years, since 1956, comes to CBS. March 21, 1980, J.R. Ewing gets shot on Dallas in the last episode of the season. Who shot J.R. became a catchphrase, and Who Done It became an international obsession. February 28, 1983, the final episode of MASH draws a 60.3 rating, 77 share. It remains the largest audience ever to watch a single TV program. 1986, Ted Turner mounts a hostile takeover bid for the network. William S. Paley turns to Lawrence Tisch, who becomes president and CEO, to stave off Mr. Turner. Mr. Tisch makes major cuts and sells the company's records, magazines, and publishing divisions. January 14, 1993, David Letterman, having lost the battle to replace Johnny Carson, announces he's leaving NBC after 13 years to join CBS. November 1995, Westinghouse buys the CBS network. September 7, 1999, Viacom agrees to acquire CBS. And May 31, 2000, Survivor hits the airwaves. CBS, through the years at a glance, was prepared for the 75th anniversary special in Electronic Media Magazine. This is Mark Dernberger.
Hello, I'm John Bowker. In its June 22, 2002 edition, the Tampa, Florida Tribune printed an article from the Associated Press. The headline reads, FCC Reviews Media Ownership Rules. The subheadline, Policy Changes May Be in Place by Next Spring. Here's the text. Federal regulators will combine reviews of a half dozen rules governing the ownership of newspapers, television, and radio stations in an attempt to make the rules consistent and able to survive legal challenges. All of these rules are really kissing cousins in some sense, and you can't think about one of them without also at least contemplating what is happening in another, said Kenneth Ferry. He's chief of the Federal Communications Commission's Media Bureau. Ferry said the study and any potential changes to the rules are expected to be completed by next spring. The final report will deal with all of the media ownership rules and policies related to the use of the broadcast spectrum. There will be a separate report on cable TV rules, he said this week. The decision to combine the reviews comes after courts called several federal media ownership rules into question, leading to speculation that a wave of big media industry mergers will result. Consumer groups have warned that a consolidation trend will lead to a handful of companies controlling all of the information people receive, as well as how they receive it. In two separate rulings this year, an appeals court told the FCC to justify rules limiting media ownership. These rules had restrictions on the national reach of companies that own multiple TV stations and on companies that want to own two TV stations in the same market. The FCC has been reviewing a restriction prohibiting one company from owning a broadcast station and a newspaper in the same market, as well as a rule that limits radio station ownership. Ferry said that two other rules, one concerning the number of TV and radio stations in a market a company can own, and another preventing any of the four major TV networks from merging with each other, also will be included in the overall review this fall. The FCC has been concerned that too many of our ownership rules and regulations seem to be founded on hunch and intuition, more than on firm, solid, factual record, Ferry said. In April, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia criticized the government's restrictions on companies that want to own two TV stations in the same market. For decades, such double-station ownership was banned outright. The FCC last year relaxed the rule to say that a company could own two TV stations in one market as long as one of them is not among the top four and at least eight other broadcast competitors remained. Sinclair Broadcast Group sued on this basis. The appeals court agreed that the competitor requirement and the FCC's reasons for not counting cable, direct broadcast satellite, radio, or newspapers as some of those independent voices are arbitrary and capricious. And that ends the article from the Associated Press. This is John Bowker.
Hello, this is Fred Bobe, and this is an article that I wrote entitled Digital Radio Other Than IBOC, November 19th, 2002. Want to experiment around with digital radio? The folks at DRM, a European form of digital, have launched websites that appeal to the experimenter. DRM is presently being tested on the shortwave bands via Radio Netherlands from 0900 to 1500 GMT on 15715 kHz, beam 307 degrees toward Stockholm, Sweden, and via RCI from Sackville at 1500 to 1900 UTC on Monday through Friday on 9590 kHz. Please check the DRM website for an updated schedule of transmissions. While you will be able to receive fade and distortion-free transmissions on shortwave, there is a catch. There will be a 60-pound cost, that is just under $60 U.S. at September 2002 exchange rates, for use of the software. According to an FAQ on the DRM website, quote, "This price of the software is to cover upfront and per-license royalty payments for the technologies, part of the cost of the software development, and the cost of setting and maintaining the website." Unquote. How good is shortwave in DRM? Well, let's give a listen. You know what a shortwave station sounds like. Let's listen to a DRM broadcast. At present, the radios that can be modified are the ICOM IC-756, the Kenwood R-1000, the Grundig Yachtboy 400, the JRC NRD-525, the Yaesu FRG-100, the AKD Target HF-3, and the AOR-7030. According to James Briggs, who is the DRM project coordinator with Merlin Communications, other receivers may be used pending some enterprising technician finding the correct points in the radio to tap off the signal. Briggs said, quote, "I haven't heard of anyone trying the ICF 2010 and Drake R8 series, but would love to post them from you on the website if you succeed. The Target AKD HF3 mod is worth looking at, as a lot of principles apply to other radios. The main problem is from phase noise from the first LO with cheaper receivers. It doesn't stop the radios working with DRM, but limits performance to the robust, that is, lower data rate, modes." Unquote. How does this all work? Well, signal is tapped from inside the radio, and it's fed to the input of a sound card in a PC. A software program available from the DRM folks is run on a Windows platform. It decodes the DRM signal for playback on the output connectors of the PC's sound card. A document on the DRM website shows modifications of several receivers. Will digital radio succeed or fail? Well, my feeling is similar to that expressed by Dave Grobner about why people listen to radio. They listen for the content and not the platform. I also feel that there is some interest in content that is available on shortwave radio today. But the question will people pay the $60 to listen to radio? For more information on DRM, visit their website at www.drmrx.org. I'm Fred Vobe. For more of All Radio Volume 1, please fast forward this tape and replace it with tape number 2.
Radio Club.